Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and this is Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network. I got to tell you, it's really an honor and a privilege to be able to talk with you every single day and to come out and talk to everybody and give my point of view and have my friends from the neighborhood stop by and take a look and see what's going on. I got to tell you, I was listening on Sunday. I don't know how much you listen to the rest of the groups that are on here, the rest of the talk show hosts. There are some tremendous programs here on America Out Loud. I was listening to the Sunday program, Viewpoint, and it was really great. I enjoyed every single minute of it. It was interesting. If you haven't listened, I'm going to tell you on Sunday mornings, 10 o'clock, look for Viewpoint. Really fantastic show. So I'm just real happy to be here, and I'm trying to think of... You know, summertime stuff, we've talked about this a little bit here in the summer. You want it to be a little bit lighter, but you still want it to be substantive. And I got to tell you, there's a couple things that I thought of doing on the light side, but I think we'll leave that for the neighborhood. Me, right now, there's a case going on out there, out in the world, of a disappearance. Now, young people disappear all the time. People run away, they leave. Most abductions are parental type abductions where they steal their child and they take off with them. But there's a whole case going on out there, and I believe it's Iowa, and this young lady, Molly Tibbetts, apparently she was out for a jog and no one has seen her for quite a while. And according to all reports that we're getting here, she's not the kind of girl that would just take off. She doesn't have some secret life going on, but she's been missing for a while. And I know they keep going back to a pig farm of all places, where they're searching this pig farmer's property, and for all accounts it looks like he's cooperating. They initially talked to him. They asked if they could search. It sounds like he allowed them to search without a warrant initially, and now apparently they've gone back to him again because they want to see what else is going on. And it breaks my heart. I have a young daughter. And I've had young sons, and you listen to these stories of these kids that go missing. Now, it's one thing if the kid takes off on their own and goes missing. It's another if someone were to abduct them or take them. As a police officer, I want to talk to my brother and sister cops along here, too. When you get a missing persons report, these are not the kind of things that we can just take lightly. We can't say, well, somebody disappeared and have the opinion that, well, you know, they took off for their own volition or they're having a problem at home. Now, we know that most runaways are actually that. Most runaways are kids that have a problem and they're habitual runaways. They leave their house all the time for lots of different reasons. But when you got a case like this Molly Tibbetts girl, she's reminiscent of so many other young people that disappear under strange circumstances. And I'm hoping and I'm praying that she is just a girl who decided to get away on her own for a while. She does have a boyfriend, and according to the stories, the boyfriend was not home. She was watching his dogs. He was away on business. So he is not considered a suspect in the case. But it's heartbreaking for those parents waiting every single day to find out, where is their daughter? Where is she? So if anybody out there in the Iowa area has any information whatsoever, please come forward and tell somebody. If you saw something, if you think you know something, if you heard a conversation, this is how we're going to solve these kind of crimes when we get information. All right, so this is what I'm looking at. There was a boy not too long ago. In case you hear that sound in the background, this is another one of our favorite animals that we have here. We do a lot of rescue. And I'm going to grab him and see if I can bring him over here. Come on over here, big boy. You want to come and say hi? Come on over here. You want to come and say hi to everybody? So this is Arthur. I don't know if Arthur's going to speak for us, but Arthur is a rescue boy, and he's part of the family. So if you ever think you have a need for an animal, you know, go take a look at the rescues. I know we bring this up here on Chasing Justice a bunch of times. In reality, I had to go over and grab him because he looked like he was going to start chewing on a bone and be really, really loud. So I'll let you in on some inside secrets here at Chasing Justice. There was a boy named Jason, and he disappeared. and he was with his cousin riding his bike. And the story that came out is that some man approached them. He had a gun, and he told the boys to get off their bikes. Well, the cousin apparently took off, and Jason did not. He stayed, and he disappeared. They never saw him again. Well, I read the article about it when it happened. And again, being a parent of young children, it was heartbreaking. And then I'm going to think probably 12 or 13 years passed. And a couple years ago, we had information that there was a pedophile that was known to the police who had been a suspect, but I don't know that he was cleared. They just didn't have anything on him to link him to the case at the time. He was in jail for something else. And, you know, he decided to make a deal. And part of his deal, I guess, to spare him from more jail time or the death penalty or some other horrific thing he had done, he told the authorities that he had information about where this boy's body was. And he led them to the boy's body. And he was buried in a shallow grave in a cornfield. And it was heartbreaking. Again, I keep using that term, but I don't know what else to call it. I don't know what else to call these things. But he was returned home. And I wrote an article that I think I'll send over to the website, the AmericaOutloud.com website. And it's called Finally Home. It was a piece that really touched me because I remember I was a young cop when he disappeared. And reading that article at the time was just scary as hell. And having him finally come home, I know there's limited joy in that other than now there's closure. You don't have to wonder where your kid is out in the world. But this happens a lot more than we think. And when you get a missing persons report, you know, the old bromide used to be you can't report somebody missing until they're gone 48 hours because people could have just run away. To me, I guess I can understand, you know, you go when you go through all the paperwork and the time and manpower or woman power, as the case may be, to take the report, start looking into it, and then turned out the kid or the person was just a runaway. So you wait 48 hours till it seems suspicious, and then the police would start following it up. We can't do that anymore. We don't live in that world anymore where we can give somebody 48 hours. You know, these crimes, when they take place, when someone is abducted, stranger abduction, when they're abducted, we have to get on that immediately when somebody disappears, especially when you see, you know, the types of victims that are often, unfortunately, fall prey to these kind of things. Young children, young girls, young boys, college-age girls, high school girls, these seem to be the target of many of these sick and twisted people who take them for their own desires, I suppose you would say. And one of the things I found interesting as a police detective that really helped open the entire world of investigation to me was to study serial killers. And you say to yourself, well, how many serial killers do you come across? Well, I read a statistic that at any given time in our country, there are 50 active serial killers working the nation. Now, I told you about a couple of cases that happened around here in Jersey that I was aware of. The one woman who disappeared and they found her body defiled and mutilated in the Pine Barrens. And I had actually worked a little bit of that case with some of the investigators because she was from my town. And then we talked about a cold case here in New Jersey that took place where a woman was murdered in her apartment in, I want to say it was 1980, maybe 1977. I don't remember the exact date. But she was murdered, and the body was staged. She was pregnant, and the obviously her and the baby both died. And there was some information that somebody on a train used to speak to her and made her uncomfortable, whatever. But that's a cold case that's active to this very day. And it's one of those things where when we see these cold cases opened up again, technology that did not exist in 1977 or 1980 or even 1990 really, was this the CODIS system or the DNA and how much of a bright light DNA can shine on a crime, and especially these cold case crimes. You know, there's evidence sitting in boxes across this country that has DNA in it that people either you know, don't know about. And that sounds funny, right? You would say to yourself, how do you not know you have evidence sitting in a vault? Well, I was a cop from 1986 to 2013, and we actually had a cold case in our town. It was a murder. Everyone suspected that it was the son of the victim. But that case, everybody knew about it, talked about it once in a while. You know, the old detectives, before they retired out, talked about the case. And, you know, every once in a while, you would get somebody would in the community would call in and say, hey, did you ever find anything out about that case or whatever? Nobody ever thought to ever open up the box and look in there for what kind of evidence there was. It wasn't until the end of the tenure of one of our chiefs that he said, you know what, I heard about this case a long time ago. Let's open up that box and see if there's any evidence in there so that could be processed. So what I'm saying is that there are cases like this across the country that have evidence sitting in them that we haven't looked at. Oh, there's our boy. He's having himself a little excitement here. Take it easy there, Arthur. We're on the radio, buddy. There's cases like this all across our country where there's evidence sitting in boxes and case files that we should pop out and somebody should take a look at. We could certainly solve many more crimes. So the instances of cold cases that are solved by these cold case units is really amazing. So if your community doesn't have one, you should talk to your local police chief or your prosecutor's office and see if you can set up a cold case unit, because these crimes can be solved. The technology can extract DNA from things that even 15 years ago, 10 years ago, we could not imagine getting DNA out of. You can now get DNA that can point right to the killer. And we see this happening all the time. We see DNA being used to exonerate people, which I think is equally valuable. I couldn't imagine being arrested for a crime like a homicide or a sexual assault and sitting in prison for many, many years knowing you didn't do it, but that evidence sat in a vault that nobody looked at. And I know sometimes prosecutors are loath to go back and open up them cases and re-examine that evidence, but I'm going to be an advocate right here, thinking about all people who were sitting in jail. And there's an old saying that says, nobody in jail did it. You know, they all tell you they're innocent. As a cop, I know that really we only arrest people mostly who did it. But if people are sitting in jail for those kind of crimes and there's DNA available, we should pull it out and we should test that DNA and find out if the people sitting in a jail cell are really the ones who did it. Because I couldn't imagine being convicted of a crime. Imagine doing 10 years, 12 years, 20 years, 30 years of your life sitting in a cell, enduring the hardship of prison life for something you did not do. And the technology is there now. So that should be something that is immediately done to try and release people who are sitting there who shouldn't be in prison. Just the same way we use it to convict people who have gotten away with it for a very long time. And Arthur's running around. I like having him here with me. He's a good buddy. You'd like to see him. He's like a Belgian kind of a shepherd. Nice guy. We thought he was lavish when he was a puppy, that maybe he was a lab, but as he's grown, you can see the mane on his hair is filled out, on his tail, jet black, beautiful brown eyes. He's really a beautiful animal, and he's my buddy, and I like him to sit down here with me. It's funny how you end up building a relationship with these animals. So when we talk about, you know, criminal activity and cold cases, the key to that is, you know, do people remember facts better after 10 years or less? So doing an investigation, when you have a missing person, we need to get on these immediately. We can't wait 48 hours or 24 hours. If anybody has those archaic kind of rules, you have to do away with it. You should at least do something with that case immediately. I know during my career, I had a girl who, I don't want to say she was a habitual runaway, but she had run away several times. And her mother came in and reported her missing yet again, only this time it seemed a little different. She used to leave after an argument or a fight or some kind of a trigger event would set this girl off, and then she would take off and disappear. And this time, there was none of that. She just didn't come home one day. And her mother, you know, I guess she waited the 12 or 14 hours when the kid didn't come in. I think she was 15, almost 16. And mom came in and reported her missing. Well, I took that report, and I could just tell in the sound of the mom's voice, this wasn't the ordinary, my daughter didn't come home last night, she's a runaway, we had a problem. And I started investigating it. And we didn't have the technology to follow cell phones around, because I don't believe there were cell phones at the time. I think I was still carrying a beeper. But what we did is we started to contact her friends immediately. And we set up a trail of exactly where this girl went the last 3 or 4 hours before she ended up disappearing. And what we found out was there was some new guy hanging around. He was a little bit older. He was 18 or 19. He had befriended this girl. I guess the girls and her friends said, oh, he was, you know, kind of handsome guy, and he was very friendly to her, and she was smitten with this fella, and he wanted to take her out for something to eat, but they had never seen this guy before, and they think she went with him to go get a bite to eat or get something, and they didn't find out till the next day that she was missing. And because we started out immediately tracking down her friends, we got this information, and it turned out that there was New York license plates on the car. They remembered that. Now, the mother says, you know, she doesn't know anybody from New York. She was 15 or 16. You know, she knew the local people, but she didn't know anybody out of New York. So we immediately contacted the NYPD, which, as you can imagine, they are extremely busy. Their missing person unit goes 24/7, and they have all kinds of crime going on there in the city. But I was lucky enough to get a detective there, and I explained the situation to him, and he said he would get back to me. And lo and behold, less than 6 hours later, this guy calls me back, and he says, you know what? You're not the first place to report this kind of an incident, and we actually have a guy we're concerned about here. Let me check into it. And this is where I found that, you know, the sharing of information between law enforcement has got to get better. Just by luck or persistence that I reached out to this guy, and I happened to get lucky to get this cop. Well, he called me back not too long later, and he told me he thinks he had a suspect. They went looking, and they found the girl there, and it was a sex trafficking operation. And this young girl had been not kidnapped physically the way we see on TV, but she'd been taken against her will to New York, and she was going to disappear into the system. And we got very, very lucky to find this girl. So when I think of Molly Tibbetts and her parents tonight, as they wait for word on whether they're going to find her and bring her home alive or in some other state, we have to act quickly when these things happen. Pay attention. And everybody, let's say a prayer for Molly and her family tonight. We'll see you in round two here on Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio News.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends, with 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Ding, 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 round two here on Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network. Here we are back in the neighborhood. We're going to talk to some of the fellas about the topics of the day, see what's going on. And with me, we have rock and roll motorcycle guy Jack, who showed up today on a beautiful motorcycle. He came pulling into the front yard. He did a skiddy, threw stones all over the place, and all the children clapped in the neighborhood. Jack, how are you?
Good, Joe. How are you?
I have a chip in my car, so do I sue you or do I sue Jack?
Jim has a chip on his shoulder, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to introduce our contrarian, Jim Giordano, here. Here comes Jack showing up to help all the children be happy today, and of course, immediately, it's a problem. Take it up with my attorney, Joe Jr., who was be joining us in the third session, so you can deal with him. How are you today, Jim?
I'm doing well, thanks.
You look all sunburned. We at the beach today?
Yes, I was.
The beautiful Jersey Shore down here. That's fantastic. And also with us here, our man of faith, Mr. Bill Dallas, who brings common sense and a sense of decency to everything that happens here in the neighborhood. Bill, how are you?
I am upright and sniffing the air.
I thought that was going bad when he was saying that, but hey, that's really good. And I am Lieutenant Joe here, so I'm glad to have all of you here. We had a little pre-meeting before we started this show today just to kind of figure out what we're going to bring to the neighborhood. And actually, Jack, you heard about a rally that pitted some motorcycle people against Antifa.
Yes, it wasn't really, they weren't really pitted against each other. What happened in Arizona was a group called Bikers for Trump in Arizona showed up at a Trump rally. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to make sure that the people and the families that wanted to attend the Trump rally were not harassed or assaulted by the Antifa people. They showed up at this rally. They subsequently held a large circle of prayer, which the Antifa people seemed to be upset about. Why they're upset about prayer, I have no idea. They vowed nonviolence, and they stood by that vow. And they allowed all the families and women and children and men also to get into this rally unharmed, untouched, and unscathed.
So what was the purpose for the bikers being there? Was it a biker rally, and then the Antifa showed up?
They knew it was a Trump rally.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Trump was coming. President Trump was coming, and they knew that the Antifa people were strong in that state, and that they were going to cause a problem.
And they
wanted to make sure that the people who wanted to support the President of the United States were able to go there without being harassed, without being possibly physically assaulted, or having something thrown at them or on them.
Well, that's great. So here we have good Americans who want to just support their president, and they were threatened with violence with these Antifa groups. And I'm glad those motorcycle people stood up for that. That was excellent.
Antifa people, this is online, you can see this video, were actually threatening the bikers who swore nonviolence, and they stood by that, regardless of the arguments that happened. And some of the arguments were quite vile. You know, the one thing I have to say to them is, if they know a veteran, if they know the parents, the brother, the sister, any of the family or friends of a veteran who never returned from war, let's remember one thing. Even if we don't have President Trump as of tomorrow, he brought home the remains of service people who were lost in the Korean War in the early 50s and made sure that they're all getting home as best as they can be found, and they're being laid to rest by their families who have not had peace, have not had closure since the early 50s. Imagine this is your grandfather, your father, your uncle, someone who died in a war. This president was the first president since the early 50s who was able to return these people to their homeland. And we're lucky and blessed to have Bill Dallas here with us, a veteran, who might be able to speak with a little more depth on that subject than I.
That was really excellent, though. It's great that those soldiers got to come home, because all our soldiers should come home.
But we have to remember that President Trump made that happen.
Yes, absolutely.
There was presidents before him, and this was never even a topic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we got to give him kudos.
It's unprecedented. There have been so many attempts at doing something like that, but Trump has been the only one who actually had the nerve, and the temerity to be able to make it happen. I agree with you, Jack.
I think what we see out of him is a completely different way of making things happen. This is what makes everybody so uncomfortable, is that he wanted to do it, so he found a way to do it.
Well, the only thing that people are really against, he's got a way of saying things that rub people the wrong way. And he's used to that authority that he's always had. And as president of the most powerful country in the world, he's holding those reins tight, and he's not letting go of them. He's making things happen only because of who he is.
Yep.
And he's got the backing of the American people, for sure.
And the backbone.
And Jack, you asked a question earlier when we were sitting around talking, you know, they're resisting, this resistance, this Antifa, they're all against this guy. What has he actually done to hurt anybody? Well, they always come up with he talks negative, it's racist when he talks about the immigrants. It's not when he talks racist about the immigrants. He says, follow the law and come in appropriately. Has he rounded up these different groups that were afraid of him and made them go to re-education camps? Or has he just made the economy grow so that everyone has a chance to go to work? Now, Jim, you were saying something before about the jobs.
No, but you did bring up the whole resist thing. And I see bumper stickers out there. Resist.
What are they resisting?
I drive behind these people, and I actually drive next to them and just stare at the window saying, what are you resisting? I just want to see what this person is like. And it's a normal person. I can't imagine what's going through their
So what are they resisting? The improvement in the economy, resisting the fact that we're not at war with North Korea, that we're getting our soldiers home. What are they resisting?
They're resisting what the news media is telling them to think. Mm-hmm. They're lambs, they're sheep. And that is my problem with most of the population in the country. They don't think for themselves. They don't see.
The sheeple. Now, Bill, you brought up earlier, you had the statistic on the labor market. What's going on there?
Yeah. The unemployment rate dropped 3.9% for July. And that's despite that there were less jobs added to that than expected.
It dropped 3.9%.
3.9%?
3.9%, which means 4%, all the economists say, 4% is the lowest unemployment rate you can get. The problem is there's too many people out there. There's not enough people to fill the jobs. You're always going to have an unemployment rate at roughly around 4%. What was interesting about that statistic is they elevated the two previous months, or three previous months, unemployment.
Another 60,000 jobs per month.
Another 60,000 jobs, and you don't hear a word from the media.
Not.
You didn't hear the word about the Korean, bringing our military.
I think only
home.
Fox News is the only one who actually covered the return of those remains.
This is it. Why is only Fox News reporting on the positive aspects of Trump's presidency? I mean, CNN and CNBC and ABC, NBC, all these other news media outlets, they have the same opportunities that Fox does. Why don't they do that? I mean, what is it about this president that so annoys them?
Well, I don't think it's the president, Bill. I think what it is, it's their ideology.
Yes.
Their ideology is no longer, they're no longer a news organization. They are now a wing of the Democrat Party. And they are there only to report things that move the agenda of the party forward. And they ignore anything. If they did a story about President Trump, the only one, as Jack said, to get these remains to come home, these bodies of our soldiers, and return them, you would have to think, people would think that would be a good thing. So therefore, we are not going to report that. We're just going to skip it. It's going to happen. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to give him that good press.
My objection is that they're not only the wing of the Democratic Party, they're wing of the leftmost element in the Democratic Party.
Yes.
The mainstream Democrats don't get it. These people, the news media, they have to be socialist. They have to be. They must love the guy down in Venezuela. And look what happened to him. He was almost assassinated today.
True. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Mm.
By a drone.
He was saying he was almost assassinated. But what the latest report was that it was not a bomb, but it was a an explosion that happened in one of the buildings, and it was like a gas leak or something like that.
Okay.
Now, whether that's true or not, who knows?
But you know what he's going to say? He's going to say, the Americans have to get me.
Yeah.
Well, actually, they're not. Most Americans that listen to that, or our friends on the left, seem to think that's the greatest place to be. I think they should go down and run there.
Socialism is making a big stand right now.
It's not hidden anymore.
Well, the thing is,
it's not hidden anymore. They're all moving towards it.
They have the understanding that certain things will be for free, certain things will be equal, but they don't understand that it cannot last. The system won't support itself, and will end up in totalitarianism. Or it'll end up in a military dictatorship.
But it won't even be equal.
As well as economies.
But they think. It's what they think, Jim.
That's what they think. That's the fallacy that most people don't understand. In that type of environment, you will have the elitists who control everything, have all the money, have all the power, get all the perks, just like in North Korea, with it. They get all the food. And everybody else would be peasants.
Yeah, but Jim, where could anyone learn about that? That never happened before.
You shouldn't learn that.
This has never happened before with a socialist or communist country.
Yeah.
There's no record to look at. There's no historical documents to check. So that's why people must think if they just did it right, if they had the reins of power, it would all be fair and equal. It would come out right.
How many times have we heard that? History is replete of the same. Every time one of these people get into power or these groups, it is dictatorial, authoritarian, and very, very violent, with people killed.
It's unbelievable. Okay, so I had something that came up on my agenda today. I was talking to the lovely Kathleen, And apparently, I'm a Roman Catholic, and our Pope came out with some interesting commentary today, where he has now said that the death penalty is no longer valid under any circumstances. Now, up until now, the position of the Church has always been that certain states within the world, if you had no other way to protect your population from an evil, dangerous person, there was no other way you could secure that population, the death penalty would be acceptable in certain circumstances. He has now come out and said, the death penalty is no longer acceptable in any circumstance. So that kind of leads to, there's a lot of consternation going on. We listen to a lot of different programs. My wife especially listens to a lot of Catholic radio. And the commentary from a lot of the priests and the people in the Church are very upset over this. Because what does this do to other doctrines, like the doctrine of a just war? How do you now go fight the Nazis and kill them if there's never any reason that you can take someone out? I don't know if anybody's heard about that.
This is going to create an entire new generation of conscientious objectors using that as an excuse. I'm Catholic. I'm sorry. I can't do that.
So do we think that this Pope that we know comes from a socialist background, that he's using this to maybe fortify left-wing position around the world? I'd hate to think that about my Pope.
The Catholic Church in the past had the death penalty. So it's not only on this Pope, it's on the previous Popes. They said the death penalty was not a viable solution for, you know,
everyday justice.
Yes, and I get it. And I hate to say, Pope, I don't agree with you. Mm-hmm. I just don't agree with you. I think there's certain instances where that death penalty is...
What do you do in these countries in the world that do not have a justice system like we have? And they can't put people in prison securely. And these people are very dangerous. What do you do with them? You just let them back out in society to rape and pillage and murder? I don't understand. It opens a big can of worms.
I don't agree with putting them away for the rest of their lives locked up in solitary or whatever on the country's dime. You know, if we can put them away and never see them again, that's one thing. But they're getting all sorts of perks and benefits and all sorts of free health care. They're getting TVs. They got all kinds of crazy stuff that the most of us don't have.
So you're looking for a more draconian type of a jail system where it's tough to go and you don't want to be there and it's miserable.
When I was a resident of Florida, all the time you would see convicts cutting down the brush around the canal systems down mm-hmm. there. And this was every single day. Mm-hmm. 100 degrees or 50 degrees, they were out there hand cutting these weeds down. And this was something that they had a work release program. Mm-hmm. It would go good for you and your parole hearing and what have you.
Sure.
Even if you're put away for life, you can still get on the work release program.
Because then you're not just sitting in jail all day. Exactly.
You're not
positive.
Just sitting in jail. But you have perks. You can get whatever it is. If you're a smoker in prison, then you get extra cigarettes. If you're a big guy, you get extra food. Whatever it is, you would get extra privileges mm-hmm. within that system. And that encouraged them to not only keep themselves physically in shape if they were trying to rehabilitate, but give their minds something to do,
right.
Nothing more.
And so this is the kind of work that you would give someone who raped a 10-year-old girl, or that butchered somebody's wife, or something like that. You would give those kind of benefits?
No, I agree with you there, but I'm saying that to make the atmosphere of jail a place that they don't want to go back. No more recidivism. Look at Maricopa County. They don't want to go back there because they're in the middle of the desert in a tent.
Right.
They don't want to go back. They don't want to sweat 24 hours.
But some people will say that's not appropriate way to treat other people. You can't do that.
Why? But there we go. There we go again.
They treat them that way. They sit in tents.
In the desert.
Yeah. So what makes them any different? Because they committed a crime? But I agree with you, Jack. Wholeheartedly, the jails, there's too many people who want to go back to jail. Because it's easy.
Some gangs, you have to go to jail before you can be a member of that gang.
Well, you know, interesting thing. When I first became a cop, I had never gone to jail. I went on a jail tour when I was a Cub Scout because one of the fathers was a jail officer, and we got a tour of the jail. But when I became a cop, one of the first things you have to do is you got to make these transports. You know, you transport, you arrest somebody, they don't make bail, you got to take them to jail. So I'm in training, and I'm going with my training officer, and we pull up to this monolithic-looking building, this gray, dank-looking place with barbed wire, and like I've never been to a jail before, and this thing pulls up, and all of a sudden, the gates open up real ominously. We pull the car in. They close behind you. The second set of gates opens up. We pull in there, and we stop, and I'm looking around. I'm saying, this is the most horrific thing I could imagine being brought in here, and there's a guy in the back seat. And I'm feeling bad for this guy looking at this place. And you can see the bars on the windows, like that court where they park the cars. And the guy gets out of the car, and I hear somebody screaming out the window. Hey, Larry, what's going on? And he's like, hey, man, what's going on? How you doing? I said, you know that guy? He goes, oh, yeah, I was here 3 months ago. You know, it's no big deal. And I said, you were in jail before, and you did something to get yourself back here? And he looks at me and goes, that's the cost of doing business, man. That's the cost of doing business. It's a whole nother mindset that I never had, that part of, you know, I guess a lifestyle of not working hard, of committing crime, whatever, is that, hey, sometime you got to go to jail, you do a little bit of time, you get something to eat, you pump some weights, you watch a little TV, then you go back into
you
the world.
You get a college education.
Is the booking area still that dark green? I'm sorry.
It's a dark green. Jack, have you ever visited? Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all here in the neighborhood. Fellas, this was a great segment and a lot of fun, and we like it here on Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network. So remember our sponsors, jpangaro.com, my company. We have Blue Magazine, the independent voice of law enforcement, www.thebluemagazine.com. MCONIT, E-M-C-O-N-I-T, for all of your data recovery needs. And, you know, take a look at these sponsors. They're excellent people. So thank you very much for being here this afternoon, gents, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Ding, 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 and welcome back to round three here of Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network. Well, one of our favorite features from all your calls, I can tell, and the emails I get from people is our Disorder in the Court segment. I think it's interesting that people find this to be a lot of fun. Well, first of all, the stories that we hear from our Chasing Justice attorney here, Joe Pangaro, is they are funny, and it's amazing to see how many court cases, how many things that seem absolutely ridiculous actually end up in court. Because one of the beauties of our system is that just about anybody can sue anybody for anything. If you think you've been wronged, you have a right to have your day in court and I guess have a judge decide whether or not you are nuts or whether the other person was nuts. So I know we've talked a lot of times here about the dogs that we hear running around. And we go to a lot of great lengths here to protect innocent animals as best as we can. It's the right thing to do. We also present, oh, there's some of them right now. You hear them in the background. We do these dog rescues all the time, and we always have different animals here. But we also like to protect babies, okay? So we look after babies, and we think about all that kind of stuff. But recently, I heard there was a story in this area in New Jersey where a guy had a pit bull, and he didn't want the pit bull anymore. So he took the pit bull, put it in a cage, and brought the cage down to the inlet near the ocean. Now, the inlet is an opening where the river pours out into the ocean. And he put the cage down by the waterline at low tide. which means as the tide came in, this dog would have drowned. And it was just by a piece of luck, somebody happened to come by and see the dog in the cage and rescue him. And I think at this point they've identified a person of interest, signed a complaint against him, trying to take him into custody for animal cruelty. So if you don't want the dog, you know, you got a dog you don't want. I keep seeing all these things on social media, people dumping their dogs, getting rid of them. You don't want your dog, take him to the local pound. Give him to the pound. Don't leave him out in the woods to fend for himself. I saw one recently, was like, guy was walking through the woods with his girlfriend and 9 puppies came running up to them. Who dumps 9 puppies in the woods? What is wrong with you people? They're animals. They're God's creatures. Treat them decently. You don't want them anymore? Bring them to the pound. Give them to people to take care of them. Okay, so here we go. We're going to talk a little disorder in the court today. And with me, I have Joe Pangaro, attorney of record here for Chasing Justice. Joe, how are you?
Hey, Dad. I'm glad to be here. Glad to be back for my third appearance. And I just say I was struck by that story too. And if we can say the dog was rescued, and it looks like the guy's been identified, and he's going to do some time, hopefully. So there is a happy end to what would have been a sad story. So I don't feel as bad now about lightening it up with some silly stuff.
Yes.
Here.
So I wouldn't say silly stuff. This is very serious. This is stuff that's in the court. So I'll be the judge.
Okay.
You be the attorney. You present to me. What's on our docket today, Mr. Attorney?
All right. So this is an actual thing that I found. This is a law. So pay attention. Anyone out there, this is something that you have to be aware of. It is in the United States Code, Chapter 7, Section 2149D, and a cross-reference to Chapter 9, Code of Federal Regulations, Section 3.38B.
Point B.
Okay. Point A, totally different.
Okay, go ahead with point B.
This sounds, as I ramp it up to you, like it is serious.
It does sound very serious.
And you know what it is?
The law is serious.
Our elective representatives spent a lot of time. You know, there were surveys and money on this. It is a federal crime for a hamster dealer to put a hamster on an airplane without providing the hamster enough water to drink during its flight.
Well, hang on a second. How is that the dealer's responsibility? Isn't that the flight attendant's responsibility?
Listen, I don't think. I've been on a lot of flights. I've never been on when she's asked, oh, do you have a hamster with you? Is it thirsty? So I think that they put that on.
So, what if the hamster had a seat on the plane? Then, of course, she could say it was like a water, a coffee, a tea, right?
I think that's what it is. If you buy the hamster a seat, you know what? Actually, that'd be a fun case to argue in court. Your Honor, I'm not subject to Section 7, 2149D. I bought the hamster a seat. You take that up with the captain of the plane.
Well, that goes along with our theme here of taking care of animals. So if you're going to ship chipmunks or whatever it is.
Hamsters. Ship is a different section of the code.
So if you're going to ship hamsters for whatever reason, make sure they have enough water. I guess you could send them with a little bottle or something, right? They could sip from it.
Now, to be clear, it's not for all time. It's enough for the flight. Now, I don't know. I'm sure there's a calculation somewhere of, well, if the hamster's 3 pounds and the flight's 9 hours, you've got to have a bottle and a half of water. I'm sure that someone's done that calculus.
But, all right. Well, let me ask you this. Now, the law covers a lot of things. That seems very serious. It does. They're looking out for the animals. How does the hamster open the bottle of water? That's what I would want to know. Right here, I put a 6-pack of water in there with him, and he didn't drink a drop. Whose fault is that then?
I like that. I like that that affirmative defense too.
Yes.
Your Honor, I read the code. I read the regulations. I know I had double the water.
Right, point B was very important to me. I put a 6-pack of water in there with the animal. It didn't drink a drop.
What's those things? The Marines wear the backpacks full of water. Your Honor, I brought a camelback on. The hamster didn't ask me for any of the water.
Now, of course, we do not condone the injury of the thirst deprivation of any hamster anywhere, so please don't take this the wrong way. All right, so that's a pretty good case. I like that. What else you got there?
All right, so I was, you know, now I've been doing this a couple of times. You know, I put these stories out. Some of my friends volunteer some stories for me. So this guy told me about a case he was working, a guy I know, and he said he was helping a businessman, a franchisee, sue the franchise itself. So, you know, it's not this, but let's say, you know, any franchise, a McDonald's, a Burger King, whatever it is, they're owned individually by owners of the actual store, and then they pay fees to the franchise.
Right. So I could buy a Joe's Happy Lollipop store. Perfect. from the owners of it, and it's my store.
It's your store, but you have certain deals sure. with Joe's Happy Lollipop
gotcha.
Store.
Okay.
So this guy who's suing his franchise, he thinks that he got screwed over by the place, and he's never had really a chance to tell the CEO what he thinks of him. And so the whole time that they're getting ready to go to trial, they're saying, you know, CEO's going to be in the room for this. You know, we're going to question him. Don't worry, we're going to get him. We're going to grill him. You just have to be respectful. Don't shout out. Don't cause any trouble. Guy says, don't worry, you're not going to hear a peep out of me.
It already starts out. You can see the train rolling.
And I'll tell you what, if it's a story on here, you know that there's a twist at the end. So they didn't actually hear a peep out of him. But apparently, when the lawyer for this guy got up to question the big muckety-muck CEO, the guy sitting at the table leaned over so that he could make eye contact with the CEO and just gave him the double barrel middle finger the whole time that he was being questioned.
And did the CEO respond?
You know what? No, I think that guy, I think he kept his cool. And the lesson there is when you're in court, be careful how you look, because the judge and the jury, I don't think, is a very favorable impression that they got out of that guy.
Yeah, I guess not. Well, and it's interesting. I know one of the courses I teach to law enforcement is, courtroom testimony and how to behave and how this and that. So it's interesting that I have an actual attorney here. I know when you and I were talking, when you were younger, and I would tell you about what I was doing and what I was teaching, and then you went to law school and you said, hey, you know what? They actually do teach us to impeach the witnesses and make them look silly and this and that and the other thing. One of the things we talk about is like, and you're saying the impression that the judge has. I teach them that if you're going to be testifying for multiple days, on day one, if you're going to wear a suit and tie, you should wear a dark colored suit, very conservative color, blue with a blue tie, because blue is true blue.
Okay.
And I tell them you should wear that because then, you know, the jury's looking at you, and then, you know, you're law enforcement and you want to have this great impression. If it turns out the next day it's going to be cross-examination where an attorney is now going to come after you, I tell them to wear a brown suit.
Huh.
A brown suit, a light blue color tie, because you look a lot more relaxed. A dark color suit makes you look powerful, and it's how you want to come across during direct. But on cross-examination, you want the attorney to look like they're beating the guy up. So I tell them to wear less powerful-looking clothing to sit back and relax.
It makes a lot of sense. You know what? Actually, I worked for a judge for a little while, and it was interesting. He said, you know, there are some attorneys you think get up there and they want to be big and boisterous and pounding on the table. I object, and all of this. And he said, he goes, the smart attorneys you'll watch, they pay attention to how the case is going, and they kind of change their conduct to make a good impression on the judge. He's like, the reason is, he goes, a judge could be the biggest jerk in the world to the attorneys. He could give everybody a hard time. But the jury, every jury you talk to, they're going to say, well, my judge was the best. My judge knew the law. My judge this and that. And he goes, that's because the judges let them take the bathroom breaks and let them go to lunch and tell them they can leave at 4 and tell them they can show up at 10. And the judges are part of the judge's job. Now, it's a silly part, but part of the judge's job is making sure the jury is comfortable and making sure the jury...
Sure, managing the courtroom.
And so they, the jury, develop an affinity for the judge. So if you start objecting just to, let's say, rattle the other side, but you're losing a lot of your objections, or you start arguing with the judge because you think, well, not only do I want to get it on the record for appeal, but I want the judge to know that he's an idiot. You start acting that way, you're going to alienate the jury, and that's going to hurt you long term throughout the course of the
case. That's interesting. And, you know, it's all about relationships. And it's one of the things in any type of a thing. When I talk about interview interrogation, the whole idea is for the interviewer to develop a bond, some kind of a relationship with the person being interviewed. So you break down those walls of concern. I want to get you to tell me something that you don't want to tell me. And if I just come across as authoritarian, if I come across angry, you're not going to tell me anything. So my job is not to berate you into telling me stuff, just like in a courtroom. I would think that the smart attorney would go in there and just try and lay out the case and let the facts do the talking. But I've had attorneys, Joe, come at me, and my last name is Pangaro. It's not that difficult of a name to say.
Well, I would say, if you're from New Jersey anyway, it's pretty easy to say. you can say it, you can spell it, no problem.
All right, it's like my website, jpangaro, jpangaro.com. You can do that, right? but I've had attorneys come up there, and now the prosecutor will start with the director, and they'll say, Detective Pangaro, were you working on this day? Detective Pangaro, did you do this, do that? And I answer all the questions. Then it comes time for a cross, and the attorney will come up and go, Detective Panino, were you on this and that? Detective Pagaro, were you here? Were you there? And I don't react to that. And the attorneys, over time, from watching all these cases, I would realize what the attorney was trying to do. They were trying to distract me from my testimony and get me upset about what he was calling me. Because what I found is most people have great pride in their family name. They have great pride in their heritage. And if I call you by your name the wrong way, it's natural for you then to turn around and correct me. It's not Panano, it's Pangaro. Then I look like the cop that everybody doesn't like. The cop that's powerful and telling you what to do. So instead I just ignore it. And over time, the prosecutors I worked with got to understand why I was ignoring it, because every time he called me a different name, he was trying to get under my skin. When it goes to redirect, the prosecutor very, very cleverly would say to me, Detective Pangaro, and that is how you say your name, correct? Isn't it Pangaro? Yes. The defense attorney called you Detective Panino, Panano, Panarno. Why didn't you correct him? And this is what I would call a softball. I would say, well, how he pronounces my name, what he calls me, means absolutely nothing. What is important here is what his client, Bob Smith over there.
Oh!
And I would point to him, broke into Mary's house and stole all her stuff.
Oh,
that's what's
God.
Important. And you would see it just devastating effect.
No, and that's because I'm thinking, you know, if he could get under your skin, well, then you look like the bad guy. But if
Correct.
You don't, if no one's there to step in and defend you like that while he's doing that, well, then the jury takes offense on your behalf.
Absolutely.
So that's really interesting.
And that's the affinity that you're talking about, where the jury, I know as law enforcement, and to all my brother and sisters out there, we know that when we walk into a courtroom now, in modern times, we walk in and our credibility is considered equal or less than the defendant. This is because of the 24-hour news cycle that goes on, the beat-up that cops get day and night when somebody does something wrong or something that could be perceived as wrong, and the news just beats the cops up endlessly. It has led to the public perception now that most cops want to do the wrong thing. They want to shoot you. They want to hurt you. They want to beat you up, and that's not what it's all about at all. But when you go into that room, you got to understand, the jury sees you today as equal or less credible than the defendant, because they know from what they've seen on TV that cops hate people for all kinds of reasons. They plant drugs on people. They're just out to make convictions. They don't care about the truth. They're just bullies. And if you don't understand that when you go into that courtroom, that it is a show. Now, it's about the truth and it's about facts, but it's shocking what goes on in a courtroom. I've told this story in my training. I've had meetings where before the court case starts, I've been called to the judge's chambers with the defense attorney and the prosecutor. And I will be told that, well, the defendant we have today, you charged him with aggravated robbery. And he's going to go to jail for 20 years if he's convicted. He lives in your town. You've arrested him 9 times before. And you are not to say you've ever met this defendant before the time you arrested him. And I was shocked when this happened. I said, but Your Honor, I do know him. I've arrested him a lot of times. No, it'll seem prejudicial if you say you know him but arrested him before. So you ought to say you do not know him. Okay. But then we go out and we take an oath to swear to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth, right? So when I get up there, the prosecutor walks me through it. When did you see Mr. Jones? This is when I saw him. I arrested him. What do you think the very first questions the defense attorney asks?
Have you seen him before?
No, I have not. Detective, how long have you been in this town? 20 years? And you have never met my client who lives in your town? No, I haven't. Are you positive you've never... Now, you say to yourself, why is not somebody jumping up and down? Because they're waiting for me to say, well, yeah, I do know him. And then the end of the world comes. This happened to a cop I worked with. It was a motor vehicle case where a young woman he had written a lot of tickets to before, because she was a very poor driver, got into an accident where someone got hurt. There was a big lawsuit going on. And he was instructed not to say he's ever met this girl or gave her tickets before. And this young man was very black and white. And it really irked him that he would take an oath to tell the truth. And he was just told not to say he knew the girl. So this went on for a couple of minutes. Defense attorney, are you positive you never met my client? She lives right in town. She's not too far from the police station. And finally he goes, yes, I've met her. I've written her a lot of tickets. She is a horrible driver, and she caused this accident. Well, the judge jumped up and down, dismissed the jury out of the room, shut the whole thing down, and wanted to have him held in contempt.
Really?
Oh, yes. He wanted to have him taken into custody for contempt, and this and that. And it became a whole big blown-out thing. And the long and short of it is everybody made nice with each other, but the trial was ruined. They had to start over again. But it's just amazing that the courtroom is about giving the benefit of the doubt to the defendant, which, if we're ever defendants, we hope we get that. But there's a lot of disorder in the court. It's not always what people think.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that asking a question like that, technically under the rules of evidence, is considered opening the door. So once you open the door after the judge issues an order, the proper thing to have done, now I wasn't in the courtroom, I'm just hearing this story, sure, but the proper thing to do is to object, sidebar, Your Honor, you issued this order, so-and-so opened the door to this line of questioning, though, mm-hmm, and the detective should be allowed to interject. So,
that's outstanding.
All I can do is give if gives the by the book one. But while I have one more second here, there was one good case. Three guys in Florida got arrested for growing pot in their house, and it was the lawyer's fault for the reason why. It turns out the lawyer had been giving them, telling them he could get them licenses to grow pot for quote-unquote medical purposes.
Sure.
Lawyer didn't have any authorization to do this. Lawyer gave them a piece of paper that he printed off of Microsoft Word, but he also gave them a sign that said medical marijuana being grown in this house.
Wow, how'd that turn out?
The cops just walked up and down the street and busted every idiot with a sign.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's a lot of disorder in the court. So I want to thank our attorney friend, Joe Pangaro, here for being with us. And we will see you next week on Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network.